You know I love you, baby. I wouldn't leave you. It wasn't my fault. Honest. I ran out of gas. I had a flat tire. I didn't have enough money for cab fare. My truck didn't come back from the cleaners. An old friend came in from out of town. Someone stole my car. There was an earthquake. A terrible flood. Logan, it wasn't my fault. I swear to God.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. What condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm tomorrow. I'm right in front of the board. Craig Pappas in the studio. S&P futures down 50. Yeah, 50. NASDAQ futures down 240, so not a... Down on 251, so I guess that's not as bad. This is after a horrendous day on Friday, so this was supposed to be somewhat of a bounce.
You're so negative, Chief. Come on. The percentage point.
Well, so we're down the NASDAQ, what, 4.25 since Friday? That's kind of a lot.
What are we for the past year, though?
We're down on this year, I think.
I don't know. You got to have faith.
There was a guy actually became one of my best buddies. Bob Johnson was a program manager at Pullman. And they were doing this Amtrak contract, right? And they kept getting behind. And he kept warning about how far behind they were and how much money they were going to lose. And, of course, nobody paid attention to him. So, finally, he was banned from the meetings because he wasn't positive and confident enough.
Yeah, exactly.
So then they let him back into a meeting, didn't say a word, and they said, Bob, that's terrific. You sounded so more positive and confident. He goes, I'm positive and confident, all right. We're really bleeped up.
Yeah.
But he sounded positive and confident. He didn't say a word.
If you go back to April 1st of last year, not fooling, we were 522, so we're up.
Okay, that's not the way people look at it.
I don't know. 5 years looks even better.
Okay. I get that, but...
We're in it for the long haul.
We're as one of my best buddy's mother said to me once when his buddy of mine made a trade and said, we're in this one for the long haul. She goes, does that mean it was a crappy trade? I go, well, yeah, kind of.
Yep.
Where do futures stand in all this? What do you make of
gold? In
the
grains we got... prospective plantings today. It's going to be interesting at 11 o'clock if you want to watch some possible fireworks. Tune in to, I'd say, soybeans and corn and wheat right about 11 o'clock this morning central. Might be some fun stuff going on.
Do you have beaks?
Yeah, beaks. Inside information. No, we were probably moving on that last week. I think Beaks probably had his reports to the important people last week.
What
bean oil went bananas.
That
was probably related to Trump calling for different oil blends and stuff related to energy.
Why would the guy, is there a subject he doesn't think he's expert at?
I don't know, but for some reason people still listen and the markets go absolutely bananas and then end up in the same place. It's good if you're a trader. It's kind of kind of bad for your stomach if you're just watching.
Well,
or if you have a position and aren't doing anything.
I seem to have noticed that diesel's less than unleaded gas in a lot of places, down by a dime or so.
Yeah.
First time that's happened. For those who don't realize, diesel's pretty much the same as home heating oil, right?
Yeah, yeah. Heating oil and diesel.
Obviously, the heating oil doesn't have some of the additives
in there. We're switching from heating oil season or whatever now to RBOB season, so.
Well,
I'm
not a chemist in that regard. Although, I'll tell you what, I was in a class at the University of Chicago that ended up only being like 8 people. And all six of the other people there, but me, already had their big offers from the big oil firms because they were into this, maximizing, they call it max-min type of thing, quadratic programming.
Min-max?
Yeah, but it's real complicated stuff. And those are the people, I mean, if you have a refinery, every refinery is set up in a certain way. And it's sort of set up for a certain type of oil. I mean, it can maneuver a little bit, but not all that much. And you can maneuver your crack spread, what you're cracking for, a little bit. But you're not going to change. I mean, you could, if you really wanted to, I suppose, get all gasoline or damn near all gasoline out of a barrel oil. But it would take forever and it would cost a fortune, right?
Yeah, I don't know why you'd want to do that.
Well, that's what I'm saying, you wouldn't. Yeah. But you can maneuver a little bit. So if all of a sudden, you know, diesel gets way expensive compared to gasoline, you can probably change that a hair.
So gas is going to be, it's going to be a lower boiling point. So you get, for engines, you know, spark ignition. And heating oil is much less volatile, and it's for furnace and boilers instead of engines.
Well, diesel engines.
Well, yeah, diesel engines, but the main users would be engines for gas, or spark ignition engines for gas, and furnaces and boilers for heating oil. So, like, for the past, call it 3 months or 4 months, we were using more heating oil. The heating oil was kind of driving the bus because the furnaces and boilers here were, you know, it was winter. So
in the Northeast, they still have, there's still like, what, 3.5 million homes that use heating oil, which you would never guess being from the Midwest.
And now, as we get into summer and more, there's going to be way more driving and travel and stuff. Now you're getting into gas season. Expect to see gas kind of out in front. We trade both and crude oil all on NYMEX, which is a part of CME.
Right. And well, you guys, that used to be what? It was a... What were the four exchanges that were in the same room there? It was a NYMEX, the COMEX, the... New York Board of Trade. What was the other one? There were four. Was it Cotton Exchange?
That might be right.
The Cotton Cocoa and something Exchange?
I don't know.
It was Cotton Coffee and Cocoa, I think.
Never been over.
I was there once.
Fortunately, the firm gets, you know, member rates at most of the places, so I can trade at a pretty big discount. So it's nice.
Well, let the record reflect. A standard 42-gallon barrel of crude typically yields 19 to 20 of gasoline, 11 to 13 of diesel, and 3 to 4 gallons of jet fuel and a bunch of smaller other stuff like asphalt, lubricants, and things. So there you go.
Yeah, and you can trade a lot. I mean, you've got a lot of different contracts, or you could trade them by themselves, too. And the exchange really makes it pretty easy in terms of matching up the volumes. So if you did want to trade some of those different spreads, that if you just ratio it differently, it works out pretty well.
I was at one of the schools in Chicago in my ute. They were oil-fired burnt furnaces in there. They used number 5, where diesel's number 2. So this stuff was kind of like sludge, and you had to keep it. You put your hand up against the tank, I mean, it wasn't hot, but it was warm. It was maybe 110 degrees, just so the stuff would flow.
Yeah.
So you needed another, I think it's the stuff they used to call like bunker oil, or maybe like in the ships you can't use anymore, at least close to shore. But this stuff, you had to use number 2, get another tank for number 2.
Well, number 2 is what we normally use.
Well, these guys, the other stuff's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And it has, you know, it has some capacity, but what you would do is you started the boiler with the number two, the diesel. You can have an igniter ignite the diesel. So the boiler would be going with the diesel, and then the other stuff, you actually would, you'd squeeze it through essentially a ejector, where little drops of the stuff would be spit into the, essentially the fire started by the home heating oil. So once they were in there, if it was small enough piece with enough surface area, it would flare and you would get heat out of it. But if you could throw a match in the tank and the match is submerged. There was no vapor. It was nothing.
Right.
It was like asphalt. A little better than asphalt. But it worked, you know.
Yeah, it's mainly, I'd say, industrial and probably shipping.
Yeah.
You know, ship. What's it called? Where they don't really care as much about the sulfur and all the.
Well, once you get away from somebody shore, you can pretty much do whatever you want, right?
Right, right. When you're on shore, you can't have high sulfur. You have to have the. I think it's called ULSD, ultra low sulfur diesel, and that's got a certain requirement for engines and.
If ever you want to see some complexity, which you guys see all the time, you know, it's not just. Hey man, it's soybeans. How many different grades of soybeans are there? Like 100?
Well, we only trade pretty much.
Trade one, but you can deliver all kinds of them, right?
Yeah, you can deliver at different prices, of course, but we're looking for a certain meal content and oil standard. And that's oil, I mean soybean oil.
What percentage of the soybeans grown are exactly what the product is?
So today we're going to find out kind of what the acreage is and what they're going to be trying to grow. For example...
Who does the survey? Is it a survey of farmers that tell
USDA,
the truth?
USDA does the survey.
But did we just fire all those guys?
No.
Sure.
And what we're going to look for today is the estimated planting area for beans, for wheat, and for corn, those types of things. And what move the markets are... call it a 2-3% move in acres. So they're going to be looking for, not only does your yield matter, but also your total number of acres. So even if your yield goes way up, depending on how many acres you plan on planting or you decide to plant, that also, in addition to price, make a big difference for your P&L. So normally I'd say beans probably around 85 or 90 million acres. Corn probably right around the same, maybe a little bit more. And then wheat would be about half of that.
This is summer wheat.
Yeah, yeah.
Winter wheat's already in the ground being harvested.
Right, so what normally, yeah, a move, a 2-3% move in those numbers, you know, is going to move the market a little bit.
Well, given the numbers you gave us a while ago, and you haven't done it in a while, how much farmers made 2 years ago versus last year? They did way better 2 years ago, right?
Depending on if you own the land, depending on your, you know, how much you locked in earlier in the year. I mean, It wouldn't be surprising if someone who didn't own the land and who was renting, you know, needed 11 some bucks to get past break even, and someone who did maybe might be 8 or less, six and a half to eight. So what they look for there is non-land cost.
Well, you should. Anyway, based on where the prices of the inputs are and the price of the product, would you say?
I would say I would definitely want for corn. If I was leasing the land, I would definitely want over $4.50. If you're not leasing the land, maybe $3.20 ish.
Yeah, but based on where all the prices are, do you expect it to be a banner year in planting or not?
I don't think so. I think it'll be high just because. It's possible, you know, you don't want to But there's going to be, I think, less planted because of the.
It's not like corn's $12 a bushel and everybody's going to plant it in their backyard.
No, that's not going to happen.
No, that's what I mean. So it's a regular year, for lack of a better term.
Not exactly regular, because we've got China, who probably won't be buying much, similar to last time. They're going to play games and all that with imports and exports and South America. But what we look at is kind of what's available, what do we need, and how much are we going to export, because that can tell you about profits and losses for the average farmer and where they really need to sell it. Because if they're forced to sell, or I guess nobody's forced, but you can store some, but really you want to be over, call it $3.75 or $4, just as a buffer,
a little buffer.
Yeah, you really want to be there, because a lot of the farm owners, and through corporations or whatever family, I mean, maybe 60 or 70% own their own land. So what you're looking for is the 3.20, like I said earlier, to keep you afloat. But it's not great when you're taking from one pocket and kind of not putting it in the other. It's
taking it from one and not putting it in the other would not be good.
I mean, they're not losing, but really, if you're expected,
it's a lot of work for nothing.
Well, I mean, we're still. I'd want to say break even for the farmer who owns the land is probably 3.25 to 3.5. So anything over that's good. Ideally, you'd like to be over that, where you could pay yourself a little bit for the land too. Obviously, that doesn't happen all the time, but you know, it's not the end of the world if you do it for a little bit. But you really don't want to start blowing people out of their own farms, because I don't know, America is kind of set on the small business, small farmer type of organization.
Well, I mean, it's you don't want to be putting those people out of business and everybody else is owned by one person. I mean, there shouldn't be you shouldn't have that kind of swings. But even a farmer, when you ask yourself, now, well, how does the planting go differently every year? I mean, I think I try and give a view on the show without looking like I'm up on a blackboard. Every time somebody does something, there's always a marginal return to something. In other words, even if you think you have the world's flattest ass farm, where it's just a square mile, some incredible piece of property in Iowa or Illinois, there's always something there that's going to be like the easiest places to put the fertilizer, the easiest places to get the tractor or the combine or whatever. So even you have a certain amount of property or a certain amount you're gonna. It's so easy, relatively easy, for you to plant and take care of that you're always going to plant that, right? Then there's always going to be areas, maybe on a hillside or something, you're only going to do if the prices are better because it costs you a little more, right? Or there's an area where maybe you didn't fertilize last year and this, you know, there's a year that maybe you wanted to lay fallow or put something else there to put some stuff back in the ground. But if corn prices are high enough, you're going to put corn back in and you're going to just fertilize the hell out of it, right? But there's all kinds of variables here. That's what I'm trying to talk about.
And it kind of comes down to it not being one business. There's a landlord business, there's a land business, and then there's also a productive operation, meaning a farm that gives you a return on that land. And people need to, or at least the farmer needs to make sure that they're doing both in a way where they can take something out of both. Sometimes you don't get that. The taxpayers have given them, you know, lots of subsidies and an opportunity to really kind of double dip. But that's the reason for that is because obviously we want cheap and reliable food. So do I feel bad when a lot of the farmers have to take a hit on a year or two? Not really, but you don't really want to mess with them too much. But the two businesses that they have are, one, landlord, which is supposedly getting a return, and then B, the farm operation, which is also supposedly getting a return. So those are the kind of things that they need to consider, because it is possible where if you get someone who's really better than you at running a farm, it's possible that they could actually pay that rent and do better than you, and it just makes more sense to lease it. Otherwise, it's a lot of moving parts at the same time, just like any other business. But the fact that these people are owners make them in the land business too, and that becomes more complicated. Running two businesses instead of just one.
When does the individual farmer make his call between soybeans and corn? Would that depend on the weather?
That's what we find out today.
Well, but I mean, if it's when do you know if it's the if you get really wet weather, you might have to change the beans, right?
You have them.
So you can't get seed on short notice?
Seed on short notice, I'm guessing you normally order it in late fall. So call it December, no. Early winter, maybe December, January.
Okay.
You don't want to be ordering.
But you certainly hear that if it stays wet for a while, then all of a sudden people go from corn to beans, right? Because you don't have, even now with the longer, with the shorter growth time of the new seed and everything, there still is a day which you can't make it on corn, right? We don't normally get there, but in other words, if June 1st and everything's too wet to plant corn, you better plant soybeans.
Yeah, that's not going to be more than 4 or 5%, though. I'm thinking that if you're...
So you're the weather god now?
Well, it's...
It doesn't usually, you're right, even
it's like...
It's local.
Yeah, it's not going to be the case for, call it, a couple thousand square miles.
Interesting. So, okay, so what's going on with the S&P futures now down 65? So we're torpedoing down here. And we've got gold is up. We've got oil up a little bit. We're going to go to break here pretty soon because now the NASDAQ is down 315. That's 1.6%. How far are we going here? I mean, we've got we have puts for everybody, but boy, it's not like we're 1-to-1 here.
I think the Qs were trading like, what was the straddle last week?
The straddle's been like some of the days it's been $4 at like 11 in the morning. The ones that expire that day. Let me dig it out here. I will.
I think it was somewhere around $14 or so for 1 week. So the Qs would be up or down $14 for a week.
A lot. Well, Friday's what day? April. Friday's what, the 7th? No. Friday would be the 4th. The 69 straddles where we started out Friday night would be 7.5. Make that $15.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if up or down 15. That's about normal.
Well, the VIX is up 266 already this morning, 24.31.
Yeah, there we go. That's interesting to me.
Yeah,
that's more fun.
I want to go to a quick break. S&P futures down 66. NASDAQ futures down 316. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas. ideas and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I am also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Matt Byrne on the board. Greg Pappas in the studio. SP Futures now on 69. Leaking by the moment here. NASDAQ futures down 330. Is this the word I never thought we'd hear again, Greg? First quarter GDP growth will be just 0.3% as tariffs stoke stagflation conditions. It's a CNBC survey. Stagflation was a term I thought we'd buried to like old Webster's we could throw out, but evidently not. We're in Europe. We've got the DAX down 429. That's almost 2%. FTSE down 119, 1.3%. CAC around down 145, 1.8%. For Asia, get a load of this, whack, whack. Nikkei down 1,500, it's over 4%, 35,617. Hang Seng down 307, 1.3%. Shanghai down 15.5%. Big moves down there. Friday, it's a review of what you don't want to look at. Dow was down 715, S&P is down 112, NASDAQ down 481, which is almost 3%, 2.70. It was a perfectly awful day. 10-year today, down 7 basis points, 4.19, a little bit of a rush to quality there. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.69. Japan down 6 basis points, 1.49. Oil is up 7 cents, 69.43, trying to get back to that 70. Brent up 43 cents, 74.06. Natural gas up 12 cents, 4.18. It's a big move considering it's springtime almost. RBOB up a penny, 2.24. Gold on a run again, up 35 bucks. 31.49, silver only up 4 cents, though, 34.85, not really following it. The copper down 9 cents, 5.03, but still over 5 bucks. Foreign exchange, we've got the pound at 107, so the dollar is higher than it was. The euro is 107, 108, sorry. And the pound is 129.5, so the dollar's gotten actually a little weaker here against the pound. a little stronger against the euro. Pretty crazy stuff. Crypto down 598, 81,975. A lot of stuff there, man. What do you have for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Yeah, good morning.
A lot of sports.
Oh, we got a lot of sports to go through today. Currently 6:36 a.m. on March 31st, 2025. As far as weather in Chicago, sunrise took place just about 6:34 this morning. 38 degrees at Midway and 35 at O'Hare. High of around 45 degrees today with a decrease in clouds. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 32. Meanwhile, down in Phoenix, Arizona, 63 degrees right now. Expected to be sunny, high clouds, and a high of 83 degrees today. Meanwhile, in the MLB, Cubs open for the season this Friday, April 4th at Wrigley Field. They'll be playing Arizona. Game is set for 1:20 p.m., although yesterday Cubs played Arizona as well and lost 10-6. Sox also lost 3-2 against the Angels. And in college basketball yesterday, men's, the Elite Eight is taking place. Houston beat Tennessee 69-50. Auburn won as well, knocking out Michigan State 72-64. In women's, South Carolina won their game against Duke 54-50. And UCLA beat out LSU, final score 72-65. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Yeah, who do we have, Mr. Flanagan?
We do indeed.
John, how are you?
Good, Tom. How about you?
I'm hanging in there. Hey, I noticed the Cubs are going to play the A's. I mean, the A's have this odyssey going on where they turn their back on Oakland. Oakland wouldn't build them a stadium, so they've been fighting with them for years. So they decide they're leaving. So off they go, and they're building this new stadium in Las Vegas, correct?
Yeah.
We also have Mr. Moriarty. Hey, Bill. We'll talk sports
Hi,
for a
Hi,
bit.
John.
How did?
Morning, Bill.
How did A's end up this season in Sacramento, of all places? I thought they were going to play at the Vegas minor league stadium. Yet the Cubs are flying to Sacramento to play today to play. Let me know how that happened.
No, I don't.
I'm sitting there, why are they flying to Sacramento? It's a Vegas airport. No, I thought there was some minor leagues, because Vegas had a AAA team. I thought that they were going to make that stadium bigger for like a year or two. The other one was ready, so at least they'd get the team in Vegas. I don't get the interim step to Sacramento. I mean, they didn't ask me, but it seems kind of odd. Very strange. Anyway, we're going to have it a little bit. John dug up, of course, on a day where the market's moving like a mother here. We're going to have a story about conspiracies back in the day. The Newt Rockne plane crash. You know, it might have been a hit. Anyway, but since we asked Bill on, Bill, what do you make of these men's and women's and what's going on in the NBA? But the men's, wasn't we ever had a number all number one seed before in the Final Four? We must have at some point.
Yeah, we had one a few years ago. It's a pretty rare thing, but it did happen, and I know they showed it on TV the last time it happened where all the number ones made it through. But this particular tournament was very consistent with the favorites winning, so it was not terribly surprising.
Do you think they're just that much better, or are they all? Well, Duke's not from the SEC, but are the other three all from the SEC?
Got two SEC, one Big 12, and an ACC team. So that's your distribution for this coming Saturday.
Well, Duke's the only one in the ACC that was anywhere near it as good, right?
No question, they were the cream of that crop.
It's always a lady, it seems, who's doing the human interest stuff. They're talking about this kid on Florida. It's, somehow he made it to Iona when Rick Pitino was up there. So you get the feeling that it wasn't just a chance thing that he went to Iona, right? So when Rick Pitino left, he must have turned down the deal of St. John's, or else he wasn't invited. Somebody else wanted him. We ended up in Florida.
I'll give you a third choice. The deal in Florida was better.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And the lady, you know, even if you have to lie, don't you at least want to lob in for old time's sake, for old guys like us? Well, like the guy started out in Iona, and he's in marketing, and boy, Florida's got the world's best marketing. Can't you just lob something like that in there to make me happy?
You would think they would throw a little cover story out there, but they're not doing that.
No, they're sort of not doing that. I
just want to point out, he was a 4-star recruit in football, and a 0-star recruit in basketball.
Wow.
Does he play football at Florida too?
No, he was in high school. He was a star quarterback. He had probably offers from, I want to say, five of the top teams, and he decided he wanted to play basketball. Even though he was a zero star, he was a nobody in basketball. He went with Patino at Iona.
Oh, he must have grown some.
He just liked, from what I read, he just liked basketball better, and he didn't want to play football.
Well, that,
but he was a quarterback who was lights out in all of his high schools.
That's amazing. Well, you know, you two guys are old enough to remember when we were very young, a second baseman the Cubs had by the name of Kenny Hubbs. Remember that name at all, Bill?
I remember him, yeah.
But he was a guy who, after his sophomore year, he got killed in a plane crash or something. But he was Rookie of the Year and other stuff. But one day, I had nothing better to do, I kick him up at Wikipedia. The dude was evidently, to this day almost, the best quarterback in the state of Utah history. And he was a basketball star. He recruited at Notre Dame, and everybody else played football, and UCLA to play basketball, and he decided to play baseball. But it just kind of happens sometimes with these guys. I mean, if you're really that talented in one sport, you're probably good at something else, right?
Yeah.
Like us, John, you and me. We were so good at every sport we couldn't choose. Not exactly, huh? Well, so what do you think? They're playing. I mean, Bill, where are these? I guess my question is, I'm having trouble talking here this morning, but where is this headed? I mean, we start seeing commercials from the NCAA time after time. Don't get mad at your players if your bet goes wrong. Is there all kinds of people after the, like giving death threats to players now or something?
I have to admit, I can't even understand what's going on. First of all, why would you be mad at the players? They're probably trying their best, right?
Well, in this world of everybody, it's a business for everybody.
They're not going to realize you're mad. And if you can't handle losing, I would say don't bet.
Well, I mean, all these players, don't they all have like websites, and they're all businessmen, right? Or a lot of them?
Yeah, I mean, I would think the players need to get a little thicker skin too. That, so what? I mean, I'm sure everybody that's ever played anything, you know, if you lose the game, there's going to be people yelling from the stands that you screwed up. And I'd really love to understand the origin of those little commercials, and does somebody really believe they're going to be effective? Like, it makes no sense.
Well, is it okay to be mad at the refs or the coaches? They don't mention them.
Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to stop that.
No. Do you think these guys have a control on this? I was at my brother's yesterday, and of course my nephews argue about everything. And has there been any sort of Illinois just passed this law regarding sports betting and what you can bet on and what you can't. Is that, you can't bet on field goals, you can't bet on first play of the game, you can't bet on a coin toss. Essentially tries to stop you from betting on anything that one person can control. In an effort to, style, I guess in baseball it would be, you can't bet on the next pitch because if, the pitcher could throw, if it's 3-0, he could throw a strike or a ball, what's the difference? Or he could throw a strike or not. I mean, it's some attempt to try and keep the crookedness out of the game. It's kind of a feeble effort, but is it just Illinois that even did that?
I certainly haven't heard about that in Las Vegas, where, I mean, I think if you tried to even have that conversation in Las Vegas, I think you'd be laughed out of the room. So that's, I understand what they're doing, but even if you think about it in football, a defensive back, in the course of a game could just fall down and give up a touchdown. And even though you'd say one individual can't control it, in that case, they can a little bit.
Well, yeah, obviously they can, I guess. What they're saying is that it can't be so obvious where if you're winning by, 50 to 10, and everybody bets on the guy missing the next field goal and he misses, and plus the coach calls in the play, the first play of the game, right? Probably.
Right.
I mean, it's some sort of an attempt. I have no idea how you know.
Oh, apologies, guys. I got a text from a friend who said that Clayton Jr. was actually a defensive back, not a quarterback. I misspoke earlier.
But a back. Some kind of back.
Yeah.
Bill, any major, before we get to Jan here, any major stuff that guys have been canceled with the Doge that is, or any projects that are already ongoing that you know of?
Haven't seen that, and what we're seeing in here in Central Texas is movement at our legislature to put big money into water infrastructure. People here are freaked out about water supply, so they're talking about kind of a long-term $1 billion per year from state sales tax money. Everybody's talking about that. I don't hear of any cancellation of the funding that was initiated in 2022. I think we're going to run that out for a couple more years. A lot of people depending on that to rebuild water and sewer facilities. So hopefully the Trump administration is busy with other stuff and won't notice this and just leave
it alone. That's a very politically correct way of saying it.
Yeah, we'd appreciate if they just leave it alone. It's probably doing a lot of good, you know, these little, especially these communities that are not wealthy. They don't have the money to undertake a lot of these things, and they desperately need this funding to get very basic facilities installed.
Well, maybe a final question, Jan, why don't you in on that? Has any community ever really been successful, tried, or been successful at limiting growth to any major extent? I know Denver's been playing with it for how many decades, same way with Phoenix, it seemed to me they're both growing like a weed. Has anybody actually been able to, they other than talk about it, stop growth?
We're seeing more of that. I believe in the last year, the city of Phoenix limited or stopped giving building permits. We are seeing that in some suburban communities here in Austin, and all of it the same reason. They don't have enough water. So that will be the long-term response. If people can't identify water resources, they're going to stop the builders. And one thing in my experience, one of the most effective lobbying groups on planet Earth are home builders. And you start to tell them that we're going to limit or stop them from building, they will do something. And they will get that back on track pretty quickly. You know, they talk about, I don't know if you remember when Chuck Percy was the senator from Illinois.
Yes, I do.
And there was a movement to pipe Lake Michigan water out to the southwest. And Percy fought it, and his motto was, keep it here and keep it clear.
Really?
And he didn't want Lake Michigan water. So people even then were imagining these exotic projects with 1,000-mile pipelines. None of those ever work. They're just, people figure out at some point they're just way too expensive and not worth it. But those kind of discussions, and you've seen that a little bit in Chicago, you know, back 30 years ago, there were a lot of projects to pipe Lake Michigan water to the western suburbs.
Little by little, they've gotten access to it.
Yeah, and I know here, you know, in the Texas, if you look at the map of Texas, the eastern part of it is a water-rich area, and the western part is desert. So there have been for years discussions of piping water from east to west. But again, the thing that breaks it down usually is the cost of piping it. It's just so expensive that it can drive you to other things that are closer by. But they're talking about it now, like maybe we build this big pipeline from, you know, the Louisiana border and bring water to the west. And that's I just don't think you can make it work financially.
Well, I don't know. And here, in this area, you the people who manage this, by the way, Jen, you probably know this more, but they're big companies that like take the Michigan water to like Homer Glen or Orland or someplace. It's not just, you know, them kicking the pipe to the Orland Municipal Group. There's companies that sort of manages, and they seem to make a fortune because those people pay way more dough than people in Chicago.
Oh yeah, just for their consumption. Yeah,
I mean, I think Audrey's dear friend Kathy loves having the spectacular backyard. I mean, it's a hobby for her, and boy, you see it, you go like, what the hell? Once in a while, you invite her over for an adult beverage, and I mean, it's just beautiful. I think she's $300-500 a month in the summer, some big number, maybe more, maybe like 700.
And Chicago is cheap, very cheap by comparison. I agree with Bill. Yeah, you know, the water resources are the biggest drag, I think, on growth, especially, you know, in burgeoning places like the Southwest. The bigger trouble for the older cities is they're not growing at all. So you've got, you know, the affordable housing ideas in Chicago to increase density and allow coach houses and all this other stuff to allow for more dwelling units in the space we've got, because the city is hemorrhaging population, and we got all the water we need to grow. But you know, the big cities generally in the old, you know, the older cities are losing population, and that's, you know, they need the growth. So,
well, there's less now because we had such a warm winter. We had no ice coverage on Lake Michigan, so it's down a few inches.
Yeah,
but Bill, what I was trying to get to, and John, I have to believe, whenever we got out of school, long before this, and people in 1980 were already talking about Denver growing too fast and how they were going to put that dam up, to dam up the Platte River, which I don't know how you do that. The thing's about 2 feet wide. And then it ended up not being with the snail darter and all the other crap that was all involved in that. So Denver was gagging on population growth. 1980, they had 492,000 people. Now they got 3 million. So somewhere along the way, their growth restriction policy hadn't worked so well.
Big surprise, yeah. I think, you know, the cities that will win in this game of water scarcity are going to be ones that really know how to manage the resource. And with a big emphasis on conservation. And an area you can look at is the Las Vegas area. They've done a terrific job with reusing water and managing, and they're in a real tight situation. But, you know, when it puts pressure on people like that, they'll come up with good ideas to manage that resource and make it go further. But that's what you need to do.
But how do you, but I mean, it seems like you're...
Is it possible to really collect a decent amount of rain, or no?
Sure.
I mean, I don't understand why that wouldn't be like the first go-to.
I think in the Phoenix area, since I had a client that was really into this, I'm talking to Bill's school here in Jan's, you can't have a rain barrel, right? It's against the law.
In Texas, you can.
Our water department gives away rain barrels for nothing.
Yeah, that seems smart.
But Arkansas, you can't. I don't think you can have rain barrels in Arkansas.
You certainly can in Phoenix. Every drop of water that lands belongs to the Reclamation District, the group that was put together in the 30s and built, what, the Teddy Roosevelt Dam? Every drop of water there, and if you, that's why these golf courses are all named after a ranch. You know, the ranch had the water rights. Our client, he used to own a big place in Chandler, and he had, nobody gets the water out there. When I say water, you can't ever use a sprinkler because it evaporates. So they have what they call flood irrigation. So he had a farm. He could flood the place, 2 inches of water, all the grass would pop up. Guys would come by with sheep, and he got like a dime a day per sheep. They'd eat the grass down, and 3 weeks later he'd get to do it again. But all those irrigation rights go back, Bill, what, to the 30s? So when you see a golf course, like on McCormick Ranch, it used to be a ranch. And the golf course bought the water rights from the golf course. And you see some that have grass all over the place. And you see some what they call a target golf, right, Bill? Because that's they don't have enough water for the whole place. So you get spots of grass. So you're on the tee, you're supposed to hit, what, the next spot, right, the fairway? And then from the fairway, you're supposed to land it over the desert onto the green, right? It all has to do with how much water the place has. Am I right or wrong here, Bill?
Yeah, I think to tackle the other question, you know, what are kind of the decision ladder when you get into a situation when you have water scarcity? And one general easy thing to do is to mandate water efficient fixtures within the home. For instance, it used to be the toilet took 7 gallons, now it's a little over a gallon to flush.
But you got
to
flush it 3 times.
Well, let's hope not. All the rest of it inside the house. Then you get into the world of restricting the amount of irrigatable area, you know, where you, like in Las Vegas, the lawn is not a lawn. It's like gravel and cactus and stuff. But, you know, pouring drinking water on the lawn in times of shortness is not considered a wise move. The other thing, going back to your golf course, which, again, if you're in a water-limited area, there's been a tremendous movement to irrigating those with what's called reclaimed water. So that takes the water from the sewer plant, which is normally discharged into a river or stream or water body, and you bring it back, you treat it to a high level, and you use that water on the golf course. Or any kind of, if you have, let's say, a public park system in your town, that water is perfectly good for those kind of purposes. And those are fairly inexpensive, easy things to do to kind of start cutting back on your water usage. But even that becomes not enough, where you have to do more. And in our situation here in Austin, and I look at these figures every day, we have 2 big lakes that supply our water, and they're at 49% full as of today. And so it gets kind of scary when those get down, and a year and a half ago they were in the low 30s. So people start to freak out. And we've got lakes around Texas that are water supply lakes that are 5%. So it's got everybody's attention, and trying to get ahead of it.
Greg asked a question, and I'll reformulate it. One time I was in Vegas, and it actually rained. God, Bill, the water is everywhere rushing. Everything's a dry wash. You know, the sides of the street that are 3 inches deep. Is there massive attempts to collect that water? There, you would think there would be.
Yeah, I think it does get collected, and I don't know the details of it, but I would say nothing runs away. You know, they've got a system to use it and reuse it. So you're right; it doesn't rain very much there, but I know when it does rain, and I've, like you've been there, it causes a tremendous amount of havoc when they get a lot of rain, because they clearly don't have that figured out too well as what to do with.
Everybody thinks the desert is like, you know, watching Lawrence of Arabia. You know, it's not. The desert is more like crushed stone, and it doesn't absorb anything. You know,
right.
There's these dry washes all over the place, and the water just runs. Crazy stuff to talk about, when Bill and I went out there, probably was around 1980. This is the growth in these areas. The entire population of the state of Nevada was 810,000. Now it's... Now it's whatever. What, 3 million too? You know, in terms of stress on resources, that's kind of a lot, isn't it? To go up 4 times in 40 years.
It's like that in many of these emerging cities, and they're all battling this question. And unfortunately, they don't always have the smartest people figuring it out. So. We're not always getting the best answers, but there needs to be a lot of attention, because we're just going to be limited on water in certain parts of the country. I think if I were living in Chicago, I would not be worried at all. I think Lake Michigan is a very robust resource, and it'll be good, and especially with the fact that Chicago's not growing very much. So.
Yeah, I don't think we're using there as much. Well, Bill, thanks. We'll have you back probably next Monday to talk about about who's going to win Monday night. When are you going to give us some bets we can make some money on or something?
Well, I think I'll give you the spreads here for the Florida Auburn. They got Florida favored by 2.5, and for Duke Houston, Duke favored by 4.5. You might want to noodle on those. And
what do you think? Auburn's got they're the number one seed, aren't they, overall?
They are. But Florida's quite a good team. You got two SEC teams fighting it out, and then Duke and the University of Houston look quite good on Sunday. So I think there'll be two good games.
What do you think about the guy on Florida with the same name as me? I don't think I left anybody around I didn't account for in my younger days. just saying. I'm sitting here going, hey, wait a minute, that's my name. So I had to root for those guys. And he played pretty well.
He did.
Anyway, Bill, thank you very much. John, we probably bagged the break. Give me your comment on the market, what's going on here, and then we'll talk about the plane crash just for air, because people will find that interesting, I think. Besides, nobody wants to talk about a market down 60 points.
Well, I think it's going to be like this, I think, for a while, Tom. There's such upheaval in the political world and geopolitical world, too, that the market is going to be tugged around. So I think we got to kind of get used to it.
Without piling into the, everybody thinks they know why they voted, why somebody else voted for who they voted for, right? And of course, nobody ever knows what's in somebody else's mind, even though you think you do. And a couple things about the current presidency. If the market actually went up, pretty much totally the last 2 years under Biden, now, whether he caused it, didn't cause it, God knows. I never really had him pegged as a friend or foe of the market. I think the market just went up because of monetary policy and other stuff that maybe he knew about, maybe he didn't. Like I said, it's hard to. But one thing about Trump's first presidency that I recall, because I do watch the market all day, is the guy every day graded himself by the stock market, pretty much. And if the market was up, it was all because of him. I mean, that's kind of the guy he is. But now he didn't seem to care. And I think a lot of people who liked his first presidency, especially people with a lot of stock, some motivation to vote for the guy probably had to do with my money's safer with him. I don't trust this Biden guy because who knows what he's doing. That's not my view. I mean, I think that view is out there. Now, I can't say three people had that view. But now this total seemingly like, don't worry, down the line you'll all be okay, and every day, but it seems like the market is basically in the crap hole. I think a lot of people that voted for him are saying, well, who the hell's this guy? I mean, talk about a change in tone. Just me noticing that.
Well, the politics have changed, though, I think. The attitude of the average person towards the market, I mean, everybody wants everybody to make money thinking that this is somehow going to, boost everybody, which, of course, it has never really happened just because the stock market does well. I think Trump is somewhat insulated from, a lot of corners where he would otherwise be criticized, because people have come to distrust the markets as being, casino capitalism, that, I can't see, my participation in it as being significant. Nobody thinks about me when they make these trades. So let them figure it out for themselves. In the meantime, I'm going to look in another direction to where I think I'm being helped. And you can't really blame people for feeling that way, just for the way
but
things
this
have
is,
panned out over the last
this
few years.
If you look at wealth, you and I have talked before, when we were youths, if your parents made $200 a week and put $20 into savings and loan, that's how you built wealth. And now I'd say that's the minimal way of building wealth. It's buying stuff and have it go up, be it Bitcoin, be it the market, be it whatever. I mean, most of the wealth, if you talk to somebody, might be a retired judge, maybe whatever, the guys I talk to, the radio, if they've got $2.5 million, it's because they put their money in a 401k, and in the last however many years, it's done nothing but go up. I mean, that's the wealth. I mean, they never made. If they've got $2.5 million, there's no way at a judge's salary of 150, that they were putting 50 grand away for 25 years, and that's how they got their money, right? It's an increase, right. It's increase in stocks and it's increase in housing prices. Well, if that were to disappear to any sort of extent, that's the wealth of this country right now. It's not as much people making $500 a week and living comfortably on $350. That's clearly not the case. I mean, that's why you see the credit cards and everything else going where they're going. So, I mean, if you're right, if the market went up, if it came down, if you're not in it, what do you care, I suppose? But somehow or another, if it goes down here with margin debt at the record high, which it is, it's a problem. And I've been in the markets my whole life. When I tell people, when markets go up on a rally that maybe isn't sustainable, maybe is, maybe isn't, and all of a sudden retreats itself back to the same spot, you think everybody's just basically back to where they started. It's not the way it works. You lose more on the way down than you make on the way up, because usually the margin.
I'm just saying that Trump is insulated from. I mean, that's the way people should think about it, maybe. And this is, you know, everybody's wealth is affected by what's happening at that level. But politically, the kind of, you know, blowback that Trump is likely to get, I think he's somewhat insulated, because, you know, a greater percentage of the population than ever is detached from, you know, the financial industry, and views it with great distrust, and sees it as, you know, a nest of vipers and crooks and Sam Bankman-Fried types and you name it. So politically, they've kind of, you know, hurt their image in a way that is going to maybe, you know, bite everybody before we're through. But I don't think it's going to translate to a big groundswell against the average, you know, the Trump numbers. Although on paper it might look like he should be, you know, taking a bigger hit politically for it.
Well, I'm not talking about whether there's going to be a hit. I'm just saying you wonder if it's the same guy.
I think he's probably figured out at some level that this is not the kind of, you know, drum beating that he needs at this point to, you know, keep riding his crest. And this has probably been strategized in a way that, you know, will, you know, cause even more disruptions in the market than people might expect, just with a new president coming in. So I think this is, you know, he's not the same person. I guess at some level you can say he's smarter. He's more bruised by what happened in the first term, and that's resulted in a kind of education that I don't think we've seen played out completely at all yet. So I'm not sure, you know, his starting point now compared to 2017 is really different.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is the market was up, I'll get the real number here, but it was up like 20% in Biden's last year. If it drops, which I'm not predicting, the same 20% this guy's first year, I'll tell you what, John, there's people pissed off. because I'll have clients that will be down money. We won't be down near as much as somebody else. I mean, that's our plan. Actually, this year, because we have so many people wanted to get into some of the metals, we're having our best year for those people we've ever had. Yeah, you know, it's not all of our guys. I mean, a lot of our guys have various stocks and stuff. It's very, very difficult. I mean, that's why you shouldn't do it. Oh man, we're kicking ass. No, you're not. I mean, some people are kicking ass, some people aren't. I mean,
saying last week about, you know, the ESG factions that are still very much alive and well, who are perfectly willing to see stocks tank periodically to embarrass Trump, or to, you know, to cast a pall on whatever else he's saying. Well, you know, they say, well, here's evidence that says exactly the opposite. So there are strategies from that direction too. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that people have done something stupid and costly for political gain.
Well, I mean, I think that the turmoil in the market right now, if when the market's down, the turmoil is coming from one guy. And
that's what the messaging wants you to think too.
Well, I'm saying that the issue I'm having, and I really do want to talk about this other stuff. The issue I'm having is I the more I look at it, this stuff, John, you know, because of my educational background, I have a much greater respect for the complexity of all this stuff than most people. Because I used to have to do papers on this crap. You know, and the more I dig into this tariff situation, the more I'm sitting there, this is so complicated. This is well beyond any paper I ever did on tariffs, and I did a couple. It is so complicated. I don't see how these people... I don't think they have five people like me there that are capable, well, I used to be, of going through this stuff and finding out if we launch this arrow out there where it's going to land. I don't think they care, John. And that, to me, that's unconscionable. Like, the comment on CBS or CM, whatever it was, it's going to make people buy American cars because the prices will be up. And he doesn't think American... Even in every car here, the amount of little switches and motors and computers and stuff and all the little parts that you don't even know that probably shouldn't even be on a car, they virtually all of them come from overseas. And if there's going to be a 25% tariff on that crap, I think the average car price here is going to be up $5,000 to $12,000 at a time when inflation is gagging people, and you've already put, maybe it won't make any difference because nobody can afford to buy a,
a car now. Nobody's buying cars anyway.
But that's not exactly the
tariff's not going to make a lot of difference. So.
They're already so high. What's the difference? Well, but the point is,
right. And this is it. Well, let's talk about Rockne because I want to.
Yeah, let's do that. First of all, who is Rockne? What happened?
Well,
for those of us that aren't 100 years old,
the Notre Dame adult student athlete who came to Notre Dame well into his life, born in Norway, lived in Chicago, and then
worked for the post office.
For the post office, I think lived in Logan Square, which was a big Norwegian neighborhood, and then played for Notre Dame, and then was in 1918, I think he became the coach, head coach.
He's considered the guy who invented the forward pass.
Yeah, yeah, that's the, if you see the the John Ford movie, The Long Gray Line.
Yeah,
you seen that movie, Tom?
No, but I heard about it.
Tyrone Power, he plays Marty Maher, the sort of the dishwasher who came up through the ranks at West Point, Irish immigrant, became sort of, a friend of all the athletes, Dwight Eisenhower, all these people came through West Point. But the scene in The Long Gray Line has that Notre Dame game where the forward pass is introduced. So it's very dramatic. It's a movie worth seeing just for that.
When we say the forward pass was introduced, it was always legal. But the ball was more like a rugby ball and harder to pass. And the conventional wisdom at the time was you let the ball hit you in the chest and then you try and corral it. And Rockne and a guy named Gus Doré, who actually was the quarterback, I think, and Rockne was the end, were somewhere in the summer out on the beach, and they decided, wait a minute, if you catch it with your hands first, it's way more effective. Because evidently they changed the size of the ball too, or something happened at the same time. And that essentially made the forward pass go, as people actually started to catch it in their hands instead of letting it hit them first. I don't know if you knew that, but that's an interesting tidbit. Go ahead.
Well, and so, he put Notre Dame on the map of the sports world, a legendary coach, par, nobody else. And 1930, the 30-31 season, the stadium that has now, of course, been enlarged and expanded, opened in the fall of 1930, in March of 1931, they were getting ready for spring training, and Rockne was approached by Hollywood to be a consultant for a film called The Spirit of Notre Dame, which featured Lou Ayers and Andy Devine, who were recognizable stars in Hollywood. But they needed Rockne's assistance and advising on the making of this movie, which was sounded like but more than just a newsreel feature. It was a full-length Hollywood picture, but I haven't found out too much about it. Anyway, Rockne thought it was good publicity for the program, for him.
Plus, he made a bunch of dough. He was making $100,000 a year back then.
Yeah, he was a precious commodity. And they needed him by April 1st, to meet their deadline for production schedule, and he couldn't swing it time wise because, of course, transcontinental travel, train travel was pushing 48 hours even on a good day, more than that most days, to get to Los Angeles. He happened to be walking across campus on I think Saturday, March 28th, 1931, and bumped into a priest who lived in Morrissey Hall, our old haunt. And the priest's name was John Reynolds.
I bet they had the same beds, the same lacquers as when we were there.
Certainly the same steam radiators.
Yes, yes.
But Reynolds had been on the track team and had been coached by Rockne on the track team. You know, Rockne knew this guy very well. He was younger than Rockne, but he then joined the Notre Dame novitiate after he graduated from Notre Dame in 1917 and stayed on as a history professor. And Rockne was complaining that he had this approached to make this movie and couldn't get out there in time. And Reynolds said he had a ticket on the Transcontinental Airline on a flight from Kansas City to Los Angeles.
Was it like United at the time?
Yeah. I think it morphed into, merged or ended up as United. But the flight was to originate in Kansas City and with a couple stops would fly to Los Angeles. And it, it took off, was supposed to schedule to take off.
So he had to take the train to Kansas City.
Yeah, took the train to Kansas City, which Rockne did. And this priest had this ticket, and why he had the ticket and what he was supposed to do with it, I'll talk about in just a minute. But the so Rockne, came to Chicago. Apparently, had lunch on Monday with his financial advisor in Chicago. Took the train to Kansas City that evening. Was in Kansas City early the next morning, and then took the flight from Kansas City to Los Angeles. It was scheduled to stop in Wichita and I think a couple other places, but the plane crashed near a little town in Kansas called Bazaar the afternoon of March 31st, which of course is 94 years ago today, so it's appropriate we talk about this. This is the anniversary of the plane crash. And the eyewitnesses on the ground saw, testified that they saw an explosion at the wing, where the wing, connected to the aircraft, and a ball of flame, and the plane nosedived into the ground. And
not good, not good.
All passengers were killed, including Rockne. And there's conflicting evidence about, the reason for the crash, because eyewitnesses said they saw a ball of flame, engulf the plane, but the people who were at the wreckage and were identifying the deceased said that there was no evidence of flame damage, although there is evidence that the wreck had been picked clean by a lot of,
It had something. I mean, talk about people not being scumbags even then. The place was totally totally picked apart by people, grabbing rings and everything else out of people's pockets. It was like something you see in the Dark Ages, for God's sake.
Yeah. And apparently the evidence later was that they were able to identify Rockne because he was wearing a ligature around his leg for a thrombosis condition, which had been bothering him. It had always bothered him, apparently. And that's how they were able to identify him. There wasn't much else that was intact to identify anybody, it seems. So Rockne was brought back by train. The body was brought back to Notre Dame, and the funeral was broadcast live on radio, national hookup. First time a funeral had ever been broadcast live on radio in the United States. And of course, this cast a pall over the Notre Dame community. Headlines all over the world about this. This is a major news event. It turns out that, and I've just been digging this up in the last couple hours, really, probing into this. But the priest who had given Rockne the ticket was visited by a couple Notre Dame students when he was rector at St. Edward's Hall. This is in 1934. And one of the people who were, they knew Father Reynolds because he was their rector, and he was apparently a strict rector, but he would let you get by with drinking and stuff if he could trust you. And he used to have students in his room who would, he would host beer, and give
you. He'd let you drink if you shared.
Yeah, and he drank. but this evening in 1934, there were two students, one of whom was Tom Gorman, Kitty Gorman, who was from Chicago, and he was the center under Rockne, and he was the captain in the 1933 season. And another guy was a student named James Bacon. And the two of them were in the room talking to Reynolds, and Reynolds opened up about what had happened in 1931 in connection with this plane ticket. That Father Reynolds had been testifying in Chicago the Friday before the plane crash in connection with the murder of the Chicago Tribune reporter Alfred Jake Lingle, who was a gangland reporter, but never apparently signed articles or wrote anything. He never had a byline in the Tribune. And he made $65 a week as a Tribune reporter, but he was really a conduit for tips and information to the crime writers on the Tribune staff.
He was an informant. And was
an informer. And, yeah. and best friends with the police superintendent, William Russell, in Chicago. They were old friends, very, very close relationship. And also with connections in Capone and with Bugs Moran, and you name it. Lingle knew everybody, apparently, and was known to be sort of a discreet but also very useful go-between for conduits of information to get stuff written up. And the background on Lingle, I mean, is far more complicated than I can go into now, or maybe the more I dig into it even later, because it's an extremely convoluted story. But anyway, he happened to be walking into the Illinois Central Terminal to take a train to Homewood in order to go to the racetrack on this,
the dear departed Washington Park.
Yeah, Washington Park, June 1930. It was June 9th, I think, a Monday. And he had already felt he was being tailed, and he was being tailed, apparently by 10 or 12 people, it sounds like. And in the underpass, which is still there today, if you take the Metro Electric trains, he was under Michigan Avenue, and at the end of the tunnel, he was surrounded by a bunch of these people who were tailing him, and he was shot in the back of the head and died fairly quickly. Father Reynolds, who had been drinking with Tom Gorman and James Bacon several years later, that same priest, was walking in the opposite direction in the tunnel that same day, going to a doctor's appointment. You take the South Shore train to Chicago, was walking west, going towards Michigan Avenue. Lingle was going east towards the train to get on the 130 train to Homewood. So Reynolds witnessed the killing, apparently ministered to Lingle, heard his confession. He asked if he wanted to confess anything. And
while he's dying on the sidewalk?
Lingle was still alive at this time. None of this, I mean, this has just come out of some other stuff I've been reading. This was not clear at all in the newspaper accounts. But Lingle was, born a Jew, but converted to Catholicism, and was married to a woman named Helen Sullivan, and they had two kids, and he,
So the world was just as screwed up back then.
Yeah, we're just complete, and, well, anyway, it was identified in the news accounts and eyewitnesses that there had been a priest present, and that the call went out to find out who this priest was, because he might have information about the killing.
And they must have known that he saw it.
Of course.
Yeah.
And, Reynolds consulted with his Holy Cross superiors in Notre Dame, what should I do? And they advised him to come forward and, say, I am that person. I was the one who was there when Lingle was shot. And he then, of course, became a witness in a murder trial for somebody named Leo Brothers, who was a kind of small-time Capone-related hood operating in St. Louis, who was in Chicago on that day in June 1930 when Lingle was killed. But it was unclear that he was the one who actually did the shooting, and he certainly wasn't the one who bought the murder weapon. The murder weapon was recovered. The shaved-off serial numbers were still identifiable enough so they could trace the sale to somebody named Frank Foster, real name Frank Citro, who was a known mobster in the Capone organization. And the although Citro was never indicted, stood trial, the idea was that Capone probably, let this Leo Brothers take the hit, and to protect somebody like Citro, who was a much more useful hitman to him than Leo Brothers was. So it's like, the fall guy in the Maltese Falcon. Give
well, didn't they always? Didn't they already make a couple attempts at this Priest life?
Well, they in the aftermath of the when he came forward and his name was divulged and he became, you know, somebody that he was given counsel. He was going to testify at the murder trial in March of 1931, and he was approached on campus at least once by two people who showed him a picture of this Leo Brothers who was standing trial, asking Reynolds in a very threatening way, are you going to testify against this person? And Reynolds said, you have to talk to my attorney. He tried to brush him off, you know, and he kind of walked away. But he also received a number of mailings in which he was threatened, if you testify, Notre Dame will be very sorry that you did. So he, of course, divulged all this stuff to the Holy Cross Order, and that they were nervous about him, that he had, was being pursued, and he was an eyewitness, so he could offer testimony. I was there. I saw what happened. When he came to Chicago for the trial in March of 1931, the other witnesses were put up at a hotel, as was typical, you know, but he was not allowed to do that, and he was sequestered at a local parish in Chicago. And, you know, sort of like a mini witness protection program so that he would not be with the other witnesses, as if there was fear that he would be killed or was kidnapped or something else before he gave testimony. But he did testify on March 27th, and in a very kind of ambiguous way, he approached Brothers. He was asked to identify the person in court who he had seen kill Jake Lingle, and he put his hand on the shoulder of Leo Brothers and said, this man answers the description, which is not quite the same thing as saying, this is the person I saw right. kill Jake Lingle. So it was very you know, unclear how all this panned out.
So the bottom line is we think that guys like Capone were like guys like Putin. You'll take out a whole plane, just take out one guy.
Well, not just Putin.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on that. There's a lot of other plane crashes that are highly suspicious.
Well, the one over Lockerbie, sure.
In this country, like Paul Wellstone, the senator from Minnesota, Hale Boggs. I mean, the list is very long, especially U.S. senators, you know, for some strange reason.
I didn't know that anyway, Hale Boggs died in a plane crash.
Yeah, yeah. In Alaska, yeah.
I knew his son. I knew he was our lobbyist, and I was on the board of the CBOE. You know his daughter was?
Cokie Roberts.
Yeah, to a different name.
Well, just to kind of
finish this up.
A little bit of a wrap on this. It's the story. I mean, when in January 1933, the South Bend Times News, which went out of business in 1938, and the archives are not available, so I can't get their version of the story. But the story was picked up by every newspaper in the country, apparently. Including the South Bend Tribune, which immediately denied the accuracy of it. But the South Bend Times News said that the Secret Service had disclosed or about to close their investigation and were about to bring charges against a suspected bomber who had put a bomb in a mail pouch on the plane that Rockne was on from Kansas City to Los Angeles, and that they were preparing to make arrests and had you know, pretty good evidence who was actually
the person. You actually had to put a bomb on there where the thing that went tick, tick, tick. I mean, there's no way you could.
Right, it was a time device, right? And immediately, Notre Dame denied that this was what had happened. Mrs. Rockne wanted no part of the story, disbelieved it completely. I would say it was a pretty concerted effort to kill the story as soon as it came out. And, you know, the South Bend Times News was the only one that said it had a copyrighted story, and that all the
newspaper was under. How did the archives disappear, John?
This has not been unusual. I found, and not just for.
What
small
I mean, the South Bend Library
The newspapers that archive for the Times News ends in 1922, although the paper didn't cease publication until 1938. So there may be hard copies somewhere in a library, or bits and pieces of an archive that could be assembled. But I found it's not uncommon, unfortunately, for there to be those kind of gaps. In any event, James Bacon, who was the guy in the room in St. Edward's Hall that night with Tom Gorman, who was listening to Reynolds tell this story, became a fascinating figure on his own. I didn't know the name James Bacon until I started reading it, this material. Do you know the name James Bacon
no.
at all, Tom?
No.
He didn't finish at Notre Dame. He left after 3 years, and then graduated eventually from Syracuse and joined the Navy, and then became an AP reporter in Chicago, and eventually he became like the most trusted columnist in Hollywood. And he was on Larry King periodically.
Really?
And, you know, wrote 3 books, in one of which he details this conversation he had with Father Reynolds and Tom Gorman in 1934. And this is really the thing that has kind of kept the story alive, I have found. James Bacon died in 2010. And Tom
Gorman. So the Secret Service never pressed charges.
Right.
And Capone was probably in jail by then.
Well, yeah, and he went down that year, 1931, and it's possible that Lingle was assembling a case for the feds on his income tax problems, which eventually did finish him off. Father Reynolds left Notre Dame in 1938 and became a Trappist monk, and was in Gethsemane, the abbey in Bardstown, Kentucky, where Thomas Merton. The great writer, Vietnam anti-war activist, probably killed by the CIA in 1968. Then he was transferred to a Trappist facility in Utah, and finally in Oregon, where he died in 1986, and gave interviews weeks before his death, in which he confirmed all of the elements of the bombing theory, and felt, so horrible about his unwitting role in what happened to Rockne. And
so he basically thought it should have been him.
Yeah, and this seems to have been the reason why he left Notre Dame and went into a cloistered, strict vow of poverty organization.
I can't imagine like Matt Byrne as a Trappist monk. What do you think, Matt?
That's the very few people I've met in my life I could imagine them.
We might have met a few that maybe should have been. We would have incarcerated them there. What do you say we do a really quick break and bring Nancy on? SP Futures down 55. We actually come back a little bit. NASDAQ Futures down 268. Still horrible, but better than 65. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
If peeing your pants is cool, consider me Miles Davis.
Welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Hoff. Matt Byrne on the board. We're trying to. Now you want to look around everybody on a plane with you just to make sure you're not going to blow it up because it's somebody you're with. Mm. So sure, that makes me more or less nervous, man. What can I tell you?
I don't know what to tell you, yeah.
Real quick here.
Who's at the ticket window watching you buy the tickets?
Yeah, well, now you do them online, so they're checking your credit card for a activation. Down 52, and as if you're down 257, we've actually come back a little bit here. I'll just do real quick, but the main number is over here in Asia with the Japan market down 1,500. That's over 4%. Hang Seng down 307, 1.3. Shanghai down 15. Europe down as well. DAX down 461. That's 2%. FTSE down 121, 1.4. CAC around down 156. That's 2%. So, whack, whack. This is on top of Friday, which is stone cold awful. Dow is down 715. S&P's down 112. NASDAQ down 481. Like I said, so we've got oil is limping along here up. Plus seven cents, 69.43. Brent up 41 cents, 74.04. We've got gold up $42 now, 31.56. Silver down 12 cents, up 12 cents, 34.93. What do you got for us, Trevi, Weather Sports, real quick?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. It's currently 7:37 a.m. on March 31st, 2025. Weather in Chicago, 37 degrees at Midway and 34 at O'Hare. High of around 45 today with decreasing clouds. Tonight, partly cloudy and low of 32. Meanwhile, down in Phoenix, Arizona, 63 degrees right now. Expected to be sunny, high clouds, and a high of 83 degrees today. We saw the Cubs. They lost their game against Arizona yesterday. That was against the Diamondbacks. 10-6 was the final score. The Sox also lost 3-2 against the Angels. Meanwhile, in college basketball yesterday, it's the Elite Eight. Houston beat Tennessee 69-50, and Auburn won as well, knocking out Michigan State 70-64. In women's, we saw South Carolina win their game against Duke 54-50, and UCLA beat out LSU. Final score was 72-65. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Do we have Nance?
We don't right now, no.
Maybe she'll pile on her. She wasn't feeling too good, but maybe she'll pile on her.
We'll see if
we
get her link.
See if she's... Jan, I think it was, by the way, thank you for that. We'll, as you hear more, we'll hear more of it. It's almost like, it's like reading Greek tragedy. You're like, God, people were like that way back then. People are kind of messed up all along the way, aren't they?
Yeah. I the postscript that you know, I think James Bacon is somebody who, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to just for keeping the story alive, just with this little anecdote that he described in his 1977 book, Made in Hollywood. But he was also a guy who everybody in Hollywood felt comfortable talking to. He was Marilyn Monroe's confidant, was in her house shortly after the, you know, her death was reported. He was with Elizabeth Taylor the night that she learned Michael Todd had been killed in a plane crash. He Bogart, Bacall, Sinatra, I mean, you name it in Hollywood, this guy was Lucille Ball, everybody, Judy Garland, they all thought James Bacon walked on water because he was a nice guy, and he was, you know, he didn't like do, you know, ratting out on anybody. He was very discreet and just was a good friend to them and a drinking buddy, and you know, everybody trusted him. And there's very few people like that in Hollywood anymore, I think. But he's a guy, Notre Dame profiled him in 2003 in a very, very good piece. Notre Dame Magazine had a whole piece about James Bacon. And he's somebody, you know, I wish I had been able to follow more carefully just while around. And I didn't know anything about his connection to Notre Dame or anything, although the name kind of rang a
bell. Well, the whole thing about Marilyn Monroe death is still, I have my views on how they did that, but they're not for
time. Oh, yeah, he's you know, I think probably had quite a bit of knowledge, and you know, had known her for years and talked to her all the time. Somebody like that is hard to find anymore, who's not, you know, frozen out or killed or something else because they became too, you know, loose-lipped or whatever. But he was, you know, someone who was, you know, kind of a wonderful guy, it seems. And everything is said about him while he was alive and after his death kind of confirms that. So if it weren't not for him, I don't think there would be much known about any of this stuff. And maybe it's a testament to his discretion that there isn't.
Well, so the bottom line is, we think the wrong guy went up for the conviction. Now, my first question would be that he already knew he had cancer or something, so he's willing to do that for his family. And it never came out, and the wrong guy got convicted, and the other guy probably lived to kill a couple other people. And but then, what's his name, went to jail and died there of, what, syphilis or gonorrhea or something? So, I mean, it was a...
Leo Brothers, you know, he was sentenced to 14 years for the murder. He didn't serve all 14. He went back to St. Louis and died of natural causes in 1950. And the other, you know, the other people around Capone and Moran and you know, what went into the whole identifying of Lingle as somebody that had to be removed is a book in itself, because there was so much going on in the gangland world in 1929-1930 after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That's kind of, you know, hard to say who's on first ever.
Well, he also had a city that, you know, I'm telling you the story, but you probably know that when the Saint, as bad as the mob was, that's why I keep thinking, not that I was alive back then, John, but I keep thinking that Chicago now, with all the issues we have with violence, and I think maybe they're actually getting a little better, maybe we just have less people, I don't know, but the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, you know, there was a love-hate sort of thing going with the mob. They gave you booze when you wanted it. They did this and that. They provided, you know, stuff that people wanted. And, you know, the guys spent a lot, and on a one-to-one basis probably weren't horrible people unless you ran afoul of them or owed them money. So there was kind of a love-hate relationship going there. But when the St. Valentine's Day Massacre happened, from what I understand, of course, when you go back and really look at stuff, it's never exactly what you understand. The city finally said, that's too much. And I think elected another mayor that was more of a reform mayor and essentially started to clamp down, because it was a growing city, wanted to be a world-class city, and all of a sudden that's, you can't be doing that, you know. And I keep thinking that somewhere along the line here, you know, some baby's going to get shot at 12 afternoon or something, and people are going to say enough. And it hasn't happened yet.
No.
And I don't quite know why. Maybe because there's so much of it, the next day is something else. But, hey, John, I'm going to turn you into a technical analyst here. On Friday, before I talk about changing page two, on Friday, the market was down on its luck, basically, on the 13th of March was the low of the sell-off. It was a sell-off from starting in January down to essentially March 13th, where the Qs, which I was looking at Friday, the QQQs, which is the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500, SPY. SPY is the ETF for the S&P 500. The old low in the QQQs was like 468. And Friday, we had this horrible day in the market. We're down, and for probably 4 hours, the Qs stood right at 469. And I'm not, you know, like I said, I'm not that much of a technical guy. I'm sitting there looking at this going, well, this is, if I was a technical guy, let's say that, I'd be sitting there going, wow, this is unusual. It's just sitting right on top of these old lows. And it couldn't break through, And all of a sudden the close basically got pooped on and closed at, you know, 467 or something. And now we're well through that. We're at 463. We were a little lower than that earlier. Matter of fact, we've come back here. S&P's are down 65. They're only down 51. So for us to pile under those old lows, unless we come back here pretty quick, most people are going to say the market looks pretty bad here. Which doesn't mean it's going to go down, because that's why they're technical guys. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, or if it went back up, they'd say pretty much it held the old low or pretty close to it. So you can, if we bounce back here, people are going to say we pierced the old low, but now we made a new bottom. It's only a bit lower, and now we go back up again. So, but I'm just sitting there watching it on Friday, and I can see why technical guys look at these numbers, because once in a while, it looks like they're brilliant. I mean, sitting there going, wait a minute, this thing is right on top of this old. And I just wonder, we're down roughly 10% here, John, and I've been kind of reporting or observing lately that a lot of people are up so much in the last few years, they almost, crazy to me, because I don't think that way, almost don't mind giving back a little bit, to the point where they're not going to change their strategies, they're not going to get rid of their stocks, or any of those kinds of things. Now the question is that Nance in the background here?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. Forgot all about you guys this morning. I'm sorry.
How do you forget about John and me?
Well, I didn't forget about John, Tom. It was you.
It was me. Okay, that I can understand.
Yeah, that I can understand.
Well, so the only female that likes me is the little dog Maggie. Is that what we're talking about? Just saying.
Well, Ella likes you.
Oh well, okay. Well, that's good. You know. Anyway,
they got two.
Yeah, there's two. I noticed how she didn't put herself in that group. anyway, before we get to you, Nance, about house, I'm trying to make a long run here. The market's down essentially 10% from the highs. Highs were 611 in the S&P, and now we're 550. So that's almost 10% exactly. And my observations have been that some people, the last 2 years were so good if you just held on to certain stocks. Held on to certain stocks. Other stocks, not so much. Because we've had people in the XLE, the XLV, actually last year didn't do well at all. Some people who were in the big stocks did very, very well. So whenever you say all your people did well or not, unless you somehow have everybody in the same positions, I don't know how you do that. You got to be a little bit more specific. But where is the number? Is there a number, Nance? I'm not leading the witness. If we get down another 10%, is it the phenomenon in trading, both going up and the way down, is people buy because it's going up and people sell because it's going down. Nobody seems to be all that concerned. Again, nobody's a big word. With the 10% down so far, what if it gets to 20? Is that going to cause some selling where people go, okay, I was willing to give back last year, but I'm not giving back the year before that. I'm just out here. And is that at some point does a sinking market pile over into residential real estate? I would say commercial, but commercial seems like it's already there. At some point, does it cause a problem in your area? And if so, what do you think that point is? 20%, 15, 25?
You know what, Tom? I think that there's a couple of categories to this. I think the commercial market is already there, just like you said. I think there's a couple of things. I think that these really big, huge, expensive homes, you know, not the little starter castles, but probably right underneath that, that were built like 20, 25 years ago. The people would like to, you know, their families are grown and they'd like to downsize. And they're saying, God, I have to fix this up. Do you know how expensive everything is? And then you put on top of that, that they really don't even want to be there. So they kind of want to let it go. And in some of these, I happened to go someplace on Saturday where the man actually said to me, I just don't know what to do because my whole subdivision, and it was a very exclusive, you know, subdivision. He said, we're all saying that we're taking 10, 20% hits. And he goes, I work so much, I don't even get to enjoy my home, which I understand. I mean, I get what he was saying. I understand what he was saying, but it's his home. So he's going to take such a hit on it, he doesn't really want to. And they're stuck on the fact that not what they bought it for, but what they feel it's worth now. And yet it needs repairs. And we all know that if it's kind of not turnkey, nobody really wants it. But like I said to him, in your price range, really, if you're going to spend $700,000 or $800,000 on a house, don't you want it the way you want it? Wouldn't you just build something? So then the question becomes, what can you build for $800,000? Or is a new building price $500,000? You know what I mean? Nobody really knows what the answer is there. So in the market, I would say you're right. The people are saying, well, you know, I made all this money in 22, 23, 24. So if it goes down, I have to give back. I have to give back for the correction. But I think when you start getting into 20, 25%, it's just going to slow everything down again. But the average person doesn't even have that much money in the market.
Well, they don't, a lot of people
they have, don't even have right. 401ks.
That's true. When you're talking the 50th percentile, yeah, I agree. What the? Nance, when you talk about a house, and Janet, we'll pine in on this, please. Audrey was selling some condos. She had people that had gave her a listing on some condos in that area over by 103rd and we're Central or something. Now, those houses went for, condos went for, say, 160 20 years ago, and now they're like at, say, 140, or they were a couple years ago. But it's not really, how do you shave this here? I'm not asking about these houses you're talking about. Watch the people never put a dime in the place. So even though they took care of it, it wasn't torn apart or anything, you needed a new kitchen, you needed a couple of new bathrooms. So essentially, you don't look at a house as a consumption good so much as you do an investment good. But she said if they put the $20,000 back into the new kitchen and the new bathrooms and made it like when they moved in, they really didn't lose anything. It's just they used it up and weren't willing to fix it back up to make it the condition when they walked in. It seems like it could be that, or now were these guys talking about, if you got a house that big and you haven't done anything to it in 20 years and you need windows, you need everything else, they might not be down $200,000. They might be $200,000 away from making it like when they walked in.
Yep.
And that's the hard part. Like, he asked me what he thought windows would be, and I said, you know, windows on a normal house, just a normal house, could be as high as 50 to 60. So what, how do you decide if you stay or you go? I mean, what are you really losing? I said to him. So I said, first of all, you really have to decide whether you want to stay or you want to go. And then how do you want to handle this going forward? Because you're right. If you retire, you're looking at a whole different financial structure than you are when you're working.
Well, we had this kind of, and John is, I don't know what side John's on this, but Audrey and a couple others are signing on the other side, where they think people's increase in credit card debt has to do with the price of everyday goods. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't, but my view is that somehow people adjust to that somehow. You know, if eggs go up so much, guess what? Even in the office, you know, I'll cook pancakes 2 days a week. I could do that, right? I mean, people adjust to that to a certain extent. If dinners out are expensive, I'm going to go once every 2 weeks instead of every one. The thing I think you can't adjust to is what you're talking about. The new furnace, okay, well, okay, I saved up $2,500 for the furnace. Yeah, but it's not $2,500, it's $6,000. It's what? I think the shock is in the service, and it's the big items that people don't expect that cause that credit card to balloon. Now, you're more in tune, or if they happen to have their credit card is involved in their business and their business isn't doing too good. I really don't think, maybe I'm just hoping, that people don't run up $50,000 bills on their credit card because they're buying furniture and clothes. I guess maybe people do, but I hope that's not really it, Nance. What is it?
No, people are running up their credit cards for things they just need on an everyday basis.
You think it's that bad? You think it's worse than what I'm thinking?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Just to keep your taxes current and your insurance current, I mean, those are things that you can't substitute flapjacks for. You got to have that stuff. And that leaves only so much money left over for the other bills that, you know, you have to prioritize. Can I live without this? Can I live without my tuition bill? Probably not for my kids. You know, other things that start to, like, look ripe for slashing. And, you know, you probably have a better sense of this than I do, Nancy, but when I see what people have to compute in their heads when they buy a house or a condo these days, what they've got sunk into it, what it's going to cost to do a new kitchen or a bathroom today, maybe, as opposed to 5 or 10 years from now, and they look to see what kind of money are they really talking about. Will they ever get any of that back in a market like this? And I think it makes people pretty nervous. You know, you don't want to spend $60,000 on a kitchen or on windows or something else if you get 30 back when you try to sell the place. I don't think it translates at all one for one anymore. It used to be, you know, if you bought a house for $100,000, you put in a new boiler for $3,000, that was, you know, you'd get that back pretty fast, and probably, you know, in a factor of two or three as time went on. But nowadays, that formula doesn't really work for people.
No, it's not. I mean, I hate to say it, but it becomes, well, like, you know, for this man, I wanted to say, okay, what did you pay for the house? What could you get today? And as long as you're getting back at least what you paid, you lived here for 25 or 30 years and you used it.
Yeah.
It looks used. Is there a cost to that? Do you have to make money on this? And of course, they would look at you like you had 13 heads.
Right.
Well, that's what that's what Audrey was saying. People forget the part that they actually wore part of the place out.
Yeah, that's in the scenario I had Saturday. It was like, well, this should be worth just this much more because I've been here 30 years. Well, and because I paid this. Well, that may be true, but you used it. You did wear it out, and you didn't do anything to keep it fresh and new like it was when you bought it.
Right.
So why are you expecting not only more than what you're expecting way more than what you paid for it when it was new, and you're expecting the person to go in and start gutting it. And you got to remember if you buy it, the windows are going to be $60,000. The new roof is going to be God only knows what.
It's got to be $100,000 if a place that big.
Yeah, there was a brief window where people could buy a house and sit on it for 30 years. And because the neighborhood was now a really hot place to live, nobody cared if the kitchen was outdated or if there were, the windows were in bad shape and they'd have to be replaced. The thing that seemed to steal because of the location where it had sat, and people were used to kind of making money that way 30 or 40 years ago if you had bought in the right place where you could ride the crest of all those, emotional attachments to neighborhoods or redevelopment or, gentrification. But I just don't see that game working anymore for people.
Timing is everything. Timing is everything, my friend.
It's not. I stopped at a car dealership over the weekend, and you wouldn't believe it was like mobbed. And I'm like, what is going on here?
They're trying to get it before.
They want to get it before the tariffs start on 4/2.
Yeah. I'm gonna ask a question, and I shouldn't do this. About I'm gonna say the education system. Everybody I talk to about these tariffs, I know probably 5 to 10% of what I think I should know. God, it seems like a hell of a lot more than most other people know. How many people are dumb enough to think the inventory of cars here, there's no tariffs on those? You don't have to buy it this weekend, for God's sake?
No, but I believe that what their thought process is, and I could be wrong, is that they're going to get what they want before the inventory gets so low like it did during COVID. And then everybody will be just in the used market.
I will bet that they're already paying more than a week ago.
You know, Tom, it's been so long since I've been in a car dealership, I don't know.
Well, we don't have much time, but one of the most amazing things is we've been buying cars, well, we know about people who've been buying cars their whole lives. The idea that there's a list price and nobody pays a list price, it's the hardest thing in the world to pin down is a price of a car, right? And what the real price ought to be. Even the CPI can't do it. They look at the list price. So there's everybody's paying over list after COVID, right? And all of a sudden it's back to under list. If all of a sudden you see all these people in the showroom and the list price of the car is $68,000, you have no idea whether a week ago you could have got it for $59,000 and now the guy wants $63,000. You still think it's under $69,000, so you're getting a deal or something. You have no idea that it's up $5,000 from the week before.
That would be correct, unless you work there.
We actually had somebody who wrote into the show one day, and good listener, an adult and a guy who knows how to, he knows his investments and all that stuff. He says, "Chief, I can never understand why the list price of a car is more than most people pay." And I'm like, really? And how many people go into an auto dealer? Most people don't go in and pay cash, right? I mean, how many people do? Or just go in and buy a car. There's a trade-in involved, usually, correct? I don't know what percentage of the time, but a lot. And most people, if they get a big loan on the used car, chances are that car is, quote, underwater, right? Means that the value of a used car is not as much as you own. So if your used car is worth 8 and your loan's 10 and the list price is 69 and they would sell it to you for 65, they're now going to sell it to you for 67, right? What's the difference to them? It now goes on your new loan. That's the reason for that play. Now, you know that. John knows that. I don't think the investing public has any clue that's the real reason why it's there.
Well, I think they do because there's insurance for if you're underwater.
Well, there's insurance for everything. First of all, How many people listen to the stuff about the your if you, you know, the Oak, was it Oak guys, if you, they'll fix your car for you. Anybody who ever thinks that they're going to give you more than you give them on average, are we that dumb as a society? How do the insurance companies pay more? You give them more than they give back to you, right? Isn't that the drill, or what am I missing?
No, it's an amazing system, isn't it?
It's beautiful. The reason why it is, most people don't understand it.
Yeah.
So
it's good they don't, Tom.
It's good they don't. What?
It's good business, right?
So you're thinking, is there a connection between the market and housing, and how soon, if the market holds on here and starts creeping back up, I don't think it affects housing at all. But I think if the market drops another 10%, all of a sudden people are really going to be pissed off and gagging.
Well, for the average guy, probably not. But for anybody, I'm just saying for a lower income or even like, you know, slightly middle, probably not. But when you start getting above that, I asked a guy yesterday, I said, how much do you have in your 401k? I just want to know. And the guy looked at me like I was nuts. And I said, I just want to know. And he goes, well, I don't even have a 401k. And I said, see, now this is something we should be discussing too. Why do you want to buy a new home, right? And you're in your 50s.
Well,
how many
companies even don't have 401ks? I mean,
well, they don't. But I mean, you would at least hope somebody would have a personal one, right?
Well, being IRA, yeah.
Yeah, the guy's, let's say, to do this, he would be more on the edge, right? So what do you have in your 401k? Because now you're in your mid-50s and you're going to take out a 30-year loan. I mean, now you're discussing how we're going to get by in retirement. You know, I'm switching the conversation leading into that. Man, when I got done, he said, yeah, you're right. He goes, how am I going to pay this when I get older? I said, I don't know. Don't know.
Unless you think Social Security is going to be like $6,000 a month. Good luck with that.
Yeah. I want to get Audrey's opinion on what's happening in downtown Orland Park, because I just saw something yesterday about, you know, the redevelopment plan for downtown Orland Park, which is all these, you know, envisioned new bars and restaurants. And I was thinking, well, is that a growth industry these days? These places are going out of business faster than they're opening, it seems. I don't know if you, in a climate like this where there's, you know, restaurants are dying, the entertainment business, you know, it's really just on a downward spin. I don't think you can, like, hold out much hope for other stuff when people are already trimming, you know, their expenditures this way. So.
Well, there's all kinds of places along Orland Wall, and there's restaurant after restaurant. And if you drive by there at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night, you'd swear, you know, they turn the traffic lights off. I mean, nobody's around. I mean, Fox's, yeah. we went to Fox's for pizza. We haven't been there in a while. Went there, and it's an Irish bar, and they close at 9 o'clock on a Saturday. I mean, I don't know how many more places. Now, downtown Orleans is a spot right by the train there, John. It's when they say downtown, it's a little, they're talking a little tiny area, right?
Yeah.
And there's like two or three square blocks. And a couple of the houses are, a couple of the places are in disrepair, and they're looking to get a little bit more back in there. But I mean, that business is all taken by the mall, so I don't know if it's going to be shopping. But to their credit, across the street there's two or three huge. The University of Chicago has a place there, and all that stuff. But all kinds of people live in there, so you could conceivably have walking distance stuff for those people. There's a little bit of change in the dynamics that would make somebody think that might go. As to how long and when, yeah, good luck with that. I don't know. But Nance, good to hear you. I'll see you one of these days. So get a load of this. I said, oh, why don't we go to Fox's? I was just there. With Nancy.
Right.
With Nancy.
We were just there. were just there, Tom, and it was without you. We talked about that.
What a good time you had. But then what happens if the two of you are there? Are you just fumbling for the check without me taking care of it?
Yeah, we managed, Tom. You'd be surprised.
I imagine you'd. Anyway, good stuff, John. Nice story about that thing. And I don't know if you heard of some of that. Nancy was about the Newt Rockne kind of cover up. And all these years, we're figuring out the poor guy's plane blew up. And I love the fact that all the people who were there first thing they did was start taking wallets and rings off the bodies and stuff. Isn't that special? People don't change. It's now we do it
greatest
by
generation. Yeah, right.
Yeah, now we do it by computer, I guess. S&P futures down 52. Sounds awful, but that's actually up from 65. And same thing with the NASDAQ, down 247. I think it touched under 300. Matt, nice job. Back tomorrow on Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. JetBlue Airways. It's not the only way to fly, but it should be. Visit jetblue.com. Empower HR, your human resources partner. That's empowerhr.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. BDL Compliance Consulting. Visit bdlcc.com. DAX Research. Listen to David Andelman on Mondays and Thursdays and go to dacsresearch.net.
My father's no different than any other powerful man. Any man who's responsible for other people, like a senator or a president.
You know how naive you sound.
Why?
Senators and presidents don't have men killed.
Who's being naive, Kay?